Just a reminder, today's conference is being recorded.
Joining conference.
Dennis Marcus.
Good morning, everybody. This is Dean.
Joining Walker. Conference.
Philip Ribola.
Pharrell Ron Martell. Welcome to our seminar on working out problem loans. We'll get started in just a moment, but I thought I'd quickly do a little bit of housekeeping background. First, it might be helpful to keep your phones on mute until we have the question and answer session at the end so we don't pick up background noise. Second, it might be helpful if you move your BlackBerry or personal digital assistant away from the
joining conference
interference. If for those of you who are logged on to look at the PowerPoint presentation, and you can log on by clicking the link in your email and in your reminder, you will find on the interface a little hand at the upper left.
Joining conference.
If you click on that hand, that will allow you to ask a question by typing it in, and only we as the panelists will see that question so that it will be anonymous and it won't identify you to the other participants in the call. And would encourage you as we go along, please feel free to type in your questions.
Joining conference.
We will have an opportunity
Sergeant.
For people to ask questions on the phone. But in the meantime, we're going to move through our presentation. A little bit more housekeeping. Number one, I think it is an absolute sacred duty of presenters to finish on time, so we will finish on time today. And as we go through, we're going to talk about this largely from the borrower's perspective, but that's only because the borrower typically makes the workout
joining conference
the lender and in some ways really drives the process on that front. The discussion is actually quite applicable to borrowers, their lenders, investors, asset purchasers, or people involved in a variety of ways with distressed asset purchases. In addition, our examples are going to be typically in the hotel area, but most of these concepts are broadly applicable to any commercial real estate backlog.
Joining conference.
Our agenda today is to talk about a little bit of table setting by talking about the context, and then to get into the meat of things to talk about what are goals and realistic outcomes. In doing that, you have to know who your lender and your borrower are and what each of them has as a motivation here. And then you have to look at
joining
what
conference
real estate asset is
Rob,
and what the alternatives to a workout are. Then we're going to talk about how to manage the process, how to deal with some of the specifics, and then get to the heart of deal alternatives and when they work best. My name is Dean Gloucester, and I lead our bankruptcy, restructuring, and creditors' rights practice. With me is Gary Kaplan, and he essentially co-leads our practice in this area. The first thing I think that it's important for everyone to understand is that this is more than just the economy. It is not really
joining conference.
When we talk about
Robert
problem
Upton.
Assets and problem loans right now, the main difficulty is not simply that we've had a recession. We're dealing with a world
joining conference,
which has changed underwriting standards, loan-to-value ratios, the values themselves of these assets. And in that context, we have hundreds of billions of dollars in real estate debt that are in default or are maturing. And as they mature, there is no replacement financing available at the same terms that were available in 2006. When a more robust economic recovery
joining
arrives,
conference,
people will expect Murphy. Interest rates to rise, and that will create its own complications. This is in the context of a new normal where I think
joining conference,
Karen Meiskensfuller,
are going to be that you're not simply going to be endlessly able to borrow against your house to support a consumer-driven lifestyle. I think the long and the short of this is there is not going to be a quick turnaround, particularly in hotels or commercial real estate generally. And in fact, there's another overlay here, which is unlike what many of us remember.
Joining conference.
1986 Tax Reform Act, followed by the savings and loan implosion, followed by the 1990 real estate recession. There's no equivalent of the RTC, which is driving fire sale disposition of assets. So what we really are seeing is kind of a slow motion.
Joining conference.
Real estate recession.
Marcia Boyack.
And that is likely to continue. Gary, why don't you start us with sort of how people ought to think about this as they approach a problem loan situation.
Thank you, Dean. Yes, and I think it's important to look at the ultimate goal when trying to work out a problem real estate loan. And we're going to talk about some various alternatives, but I think it makes sense to be realistic about what's likely to work ahead of time before proceeding down that path. And typically the first question that a borrower really needs to ask itself is whether the asset itself, as a practical matter, can be saved. In other words, does it make sense to go through all the trouble and the expense of trying to go through one of these alternatives if at the end of the day it's not going to be an ultimate benefit? For example,
joining conference.
There can be a workout achieved with a senior lender, but at the only benefit of that is buying some time, and there's still a junior lien that's perhaps accruing default interest, such that all the upside is going to go to the benefit of the junior lien holder rather than the owner down the road. It may not make sense for the borrower to go through all this trouble and perhaps incur additional personal obligations along the way. So that really requires looking down the road a couple of years and trying to get a sense for when the real estate credit markets calm down and perhaps get to a better state, whether it's likely to have some real upside for the borrower, looking at all the circumstances, including what the situation is with a junior lender, not just a senior lender. And, you know, as part of this calculus, one of the first things to look at is whether a fire sale is going to make sense. I mean, typically, fire sale doesn't really benefit anyone. That's just a quick liquidation to try to stop the bleeding. But, you know, oftentimes the only one that possibly benefits there is the senior lender if it can afford to hang on to the property and resell it in an orderly sale.
Joining conference.
So, Michael Hooper.
Part of the calculus is also, I think folks need to get realistic on both the borrower side and the lender side. And it's not really just borrowers that are often in denial about the potential future property. It's often lenders themselves are also in denial in that they are essentially funding operations for a losing property, which they own in every respect except in name, if at the end of the day it's clear the property is going to end up in the owner's hand. And I think it's important for the lender as well as the borrower to recognize early on if that's the situation. And Dean's going to talk a little bit about lender motivations in that context.
I think it's particularly, for those of us who live and work in the workout area, it's particularly frustrating that many or perhaps even most borrowers do not
joining conference
that their lender has a radically different motivation than they do. Lending is fundamentally a low-margin business, that the lender does not get an upside on the project. And when a borrower comes and says, well, don't foreclose, it's going to wipe out my investors, that is not the lender's problem. The lender wants to recover the principal and interest on the loan. It is not relevant to them about whether the borrower's investors come out with an upside return. It is also true that lenders don't have the resources to deal with difficult operational problems. They're not interested in coming in and doing asbestos removal or dealing with a leaking underground storage tank or building out the last four floors.
Joining conference.
And then leasing it up after that. But the truth is most hotels and most commercial real estate projects that are finished are not actually difficult operations. Particularly hotels, you often have a management company in there already running the thing. You've got an internment non-disturbance and coordination agreement that's going to leave them in there even after a foreclosure. And unlike an operating business where you make widgets or you make feeder siding, it's not as difficult for a lender to simply step in and say, you know, we can sell that as easily as you can. It's important to understand that different categories of lenders have very different kinds of motivations in the workout context. Banks have the same sort of issue everyone else does, which is they want to get paid their principal and their interest, but they also often have regulatory and accounting issues, so that individual banks might have a particular issue about having something be a performing loan.
Joining conference.
If they have to reserve against non-performing loans, they can't use those reserves to go make other money with them. In addition, publicly traded companies in general, not just banks, but publicly traded companies, tend to manage toward the end of a quarter. And they sometimes have motivations which would seem counterintuitive from the outside, which is, look, we've just decided we're going to take all of our hits to the bad loans this quarter, and we're going to go ahead and write this off, and we're going to take care of it. But things happen for publicly traded companies at the end of every calendar quarter and at the end of the fiscal year. Insurance companies are typically a bit different than other lenders because they have their own real estate portfolio. They invest in real estate. As a result, they're not afraid of owning the asset. That's part of their core business. It is not the core business of a bank to own commercial real estate assets, but it is of an insurance company. And then it's important to understand the special circumstances of these conduit loans. The CMBS loans, which are mortgage-backed securities. In a CMBS loan, you have a general servicer who deals with it until it becomes a workout, and the general servicer literally has no ability to talk to you about a workout. When you want to modify the terms of the loan, then it gets transferred to the special servicer, and to be only slightly cynical about this, a CMBS special servicer has only two rules. One, maximize fees, and two, don't get sued by your bondholders who often own this in different tranches. That severely limits their flexibility in doing workouts. Then mezzanine lenders are typically, you know, in the hotel context, they are often out of the money right now, and they either want to get cashed out or they will simply sit out there and hope that the owner continues to feed the first and keep things out of foreclosure, at which point at some point in the future when things turn around, they will get the upside. It's sort of almost like alchemy. They've discovered a way to monetize the Nile. So as the owner continues to feed the project, the owner's doing it for the benefit of the mezzanine lender. A lender's view of the owner is absolutely critical in a workout. First, is the owner honest? If the owner's not honest, you're not going to get very far with a workout. So if you skim the rents, if you make promises and don't keep them, if you do
joining conference.
John Fisher, 15 minutes late due to the SoundPath eView website.
Then you are not going to be successful in getting a workout with your lender. Is the borrower competent? That's often. Is the borrower better informed about the asset? Almost certainly. Is the borrower in denial? The borrower, in the lender's view, is always, always, always in denial, and the lender's view is backed up by experience, which is every owner and every borrower they encounter in the workout situation is in denial about how bad the problem is, how quickly one has to move. People are talking about the bank advancing more money when they ought to be talking about finding a buyer for the asset. They're talking about raising more money from their investors after the point where that's no longer possible. They tend to be not as far along in the process as they should be. Finally, the key question in a workout is, does the owner-borrower have a better, cheaper, faster plan for the lender's benefit? So can the owner deliver something that's better than what's behind door number two of foreclosure?
Just to check.
And I think there it's important to understand what is line door number two. So Gary, maybe you could talk to us about what the alternatives are for the lender.
Essentially, there's three primary alternatives, and we're going to talk about each of them in detail as we move on for a lender as opposed to doing a workout with a borrower. And the first, and these days is more and more common, is for the lender to essentially sell the loan to whoever will buy it. And there are bottom feeders or folks that will buy on spec notes that are often on properties underwater, either private equity funds or distressed debt funds, that will buy these things in the hopes that they can make them work and turn them into a profit in the long run.
And often these days, that's actually purely an asset play. So someone who wants to buy the property sees that the owner's out of the money and is not motivated and it's not going to happen, and they just say, look, I want to buy the first and I'll just foreclose.
Exactly. And then the other major alternative a lender would have to a workout would be to foreclose on the asset itself. And we're going to go through some of the nuts and bolts as to how that would work. And then last would be what's known as a deed in lieu of foreclosure that many of you may be familiar with, which essentially is the borrower voluntarily turning over the property to the lender versus going through a more formal foreclosure procedure. And we're going to talk about each of these particular alternatives in a little more detail now. Dean, why don't you start us off with the foreclosure option?
Well, if the lender forecloses, the first thing that happens is there's going to be some delay in the process, even if there's not an intervening bankruptcy. In California, the fastest way to foreclose is non-judicially. You record a notice of default. 90 days later, you record a notice of sale. Something on the order of 21 days later, you can actually have a sale of the property and it changes hands. Personal property can be foreclosed on in 10 days notice, but it tends to be a little bit more complicated because with personal property, you actually have to have a commercially reasonable sale if you want to preserve your right to go after the borrower or guarantor for a deficiency. Where you've got a property that's generating cash, rents, hotel revenues, typically during the foreclosure process, you would get the appointment of a receiver pre-foreclosure so that someone who is a receiver is actually going to go in there and collect those rents and see to it that the operating expenses are paid during that process. That's actually quite expensive and ultimately comes out of what is available to pay the lender at the end of the day. The lender who forecloses may be able to sue on guarantees if they are ultimately not paid. They can hold the asset, so bid in the debt, and then resell it later in an orderly process so that when borrowers go to lenders and say, well, you know, you'll lose everything if you have a fire sale, the lender says, well, you know, I can hold this for sale as easily as you can, and unless you can persuade me that you're better at selling it than I would be, you know, you have to give me another reason not to simply foreclose. The other alternative is the lender can simply sell it to a buyer at the foreclosure sale. The owner has some alternatives to work out. Gary, why don't you walk us through those?
Sure. First, you know, the big threat that a lot of owners have is to essentially hand the keys over to the lender and say, I'm done. But of course, that strategy only works if there's real leverage on the owner's side and if the owner otherwise has obligations that it can't simply walk away from, that threat is not as powerful. For example, often owners give personal or the principals of the property owner often give personal guarantees that they're still on the hook for even if the property is handed over by the actual borrower. And also, typically, if it's an operating company, there's other major obligations that the entity has that it can't simply walk away from. Things like management agreements and the like won't go away simply by handing the keys to the lender. Likewise, there may be environmental liabilities that the property may have that the owners could be personally responsible for, and again, handing the keys over to the lender won't solve all problems there. And there also could be renovations and the like, which are in midstream that the owners have also personally obligated themselves to finish. And again, handing the keys over may not be the complete solution there.
And the other issue is really, if you're in an operating company that makes furniture, it's very difficult. And if the owners of that business walk away, it doesn't operate itself. you can't collect the accounts receivable, it becomes enormously difficult. If you simply have a hotel and there's someone already operating it under a management agreement, the threat to walk away and hand the keys over is not much of a threat.
Exactly. And another major alternative is to file bankruptcy, and we'll get to in a moment some of the advantages and potential risks in filing a bankruptcy case. The bankruptcy choice may just not be practical as an alternative for reasons we'll get to. And finally, the other alternative that an owner has is to try to do a short sale with a new buyer or to try to refinance the property. But as a practical matter, especially in this market where we're still, still a credit crunch, and the real estate market is not vibrant in many parts of the country, this may not be a practical alternative because a short sale requires an actual ready, willing, and able buyer, and a refinancing requires a cooperative lender. And these things may not be present in today's economy. So in terms of the bankruptcy alternative, first, let me mention why bankruptcy won't always work, and then we can talk about some of the advantages that a bankruptcy can have if indeed it is a viable alternative. One thing to keep in mind in terms of a big picture is that bankruptcy is really the option of last resort. Number one, it's very expensive. Number two, it's very time consuming. Number three, it creates an adversarial process with the lender. So once one goes down that road, it's harder to work things out cooperatively with the lender. So it really should be considered the last thing one does if the other alternatives don't work. And also the things to keep in mind in filing a bankruptcy is that it's not necessarily a magical solution. If, for example, the company does not have, or borrower does not have operating cash to begin with, bankruptcy is not going to suddenly create cash for the borrower. All it's going to do is create really a temporary breathing space and a possibility to get some negotiating leverage that we'll talk about in a moment. The other thing to keep in mind is that bankruptcy has some very large upfront costs typically. For example, any competent counsel, bankruptcy counsel, will want a retainer of a substantial amount to pay for their expected fees during the bankruptcy case, knowing that there's no other source of likely payment for their fees if a property is fully encumbered. And while it's beyond the scope of this seminar to go through all the nuts and bolts of a Chapter 11 bankruptcy plan, one important gatekeeping issue is that there is no way to confirm a bankruptcy plan and essentially get through a bankruptcy unless a class of creditors that's what's known as impaired actually approves the plan. And just briefly, in a bankruptcy plan, all the creditors' claims are divided into various groups or classes. They all get to vote on the plan, and they need to approve it in a certain number, and which it's both two-thirds of dollar amount in each class and a half of the actual creditors voting in each class must vote to approve it for that class to be deemed to approve it or accept the plan. And if there's any class, there must be at least one class that's what's known as impaired, meaning their rights are somehow changed through the plan, that votes to accept the plan. And if all the classes reject it, then the plan cannot go through and bankruptcy just won't work. So ahead of time, a borrower needs to figure out whether it's going to be able to have an accepting class under its plan. Otherwise, bankruptcy is a waste of time and money. The other thing to keep in mind is that bankruptcy, generally speaking, will not make personal guarantees go away that the principals of the borrower have, and in fact may trigger liability under so-called bad boy guarantees, in which liability only springs up if things like a bankruptcy is filed by the borrower. One other concept to keep in mind, again without going into too much technical discussion, is that typically an owner in bankruptcy cannot keep its interest unless all of the classes above it, all the creditors above it, are paid in full. That's known as the absolute priority rule. So the benefit of the bankruptcy, it may benefit the creditors in terms of being able to get something on what the money they've lent, but at the end of the day, the owner may not be able to keep its interest unless it puts in substantial money through the bankruptcy process.
And it's important to understand all that, because if a borrower goes to the lender and says, you need to do this workout with me because otherwise I will file bankruptcy and such and such and such will happen, in negotiations, if you're going to make a threat or you're going to say, I have an alternative, the alternative or threat has to be plausible. And frankly, these days, lenders and counsel are quite sophisticated about what works and what does not work. But there are parts of bankruptcy that do work.
Yes, and indeed, thank you, Dean. And the things that one can do in a bankruptcy case that can't always be done outside the bankruptcy is substantially change the terms of the borrowing agreements with lenders, including secured lenders. For example, the bankruptcy code allows a debtor in bankruptcy through a bankruptcy plan to restructure the loan on in various respects. The maturity of the loan can be extended, sometimes substantially. Interest rates can actually be changed, and the timing for when payments are required can be changed as well through a bankruptcy plan. And even the non-monetary terms of a loan agreement can be changed. For example, an agreement that otherwise requires payment in full through an acceleration clause if the property is transferred or refinanced essentially would not be enforced in bankruptcy, and those terms can essentially be overridden through a bankruptcy plan. Likewise, even if the loan documents prohibit any other borrowing on the property, even junior debt coming in through a bankruptcy plan, in fact, the borrower or the debtor can put on new debt on the property through the bankruptcy process. Another advantage of bankruptcy is that lower tier creditors, the unsecured creditors or junior secured creditors, can essentially be repaid at a deep discount, often a fraction of what they're owed, or have their interest converted to equity interest in the reorganized company instead of being owed a debt obligation. And this can be done even without their consent under the so-called cram down process. Likewise, one other thing one could do in a bankruptcy, even if loan documents are prohibited, is to sell the assets that the debtor has and have the proceeds of that sale go to pay off the lender, even if there's not full money to pay the entire loan in full. And you know, in fact, what the real large benefit for at least real estate entities in filing bankruptcy is really to buy some time and to get breathing room, because if at a minimum, the borrower in bankruptcy will get a few months to try to restructure it. And typically during that time, negotiations go on with the lender to try to do a consensual resolution of the debt, you know, with the specter of the lender's understanding. There may be a bankruptcy plan down the road that does all these horrible things to their loan documents, and they're often much more willing to play ball if they realize that the bankruptcy process is going on and their rights may be substantially changed in bankruptcy. I should mention an earlier webinar that we did that should be available on the website soon, I think, which there's still some technical issues going on, talked about the issue of buying hotels and similar commercial real estate assets out of bankruptcy, and that webinar talks a little bit more about these topics in detail. And Dean, maybe you can talk about the managing the lender process as well.
Sure, and it's important to understand where one would come out in a bankruptcy because it really shapes the workout negotiation. A lot of times, the point of even where there is, you know, a successful possibility of a bankruptcy plan, anything you can accomplish in bankruptcy between a lender and a borrower, almost all of those things can be done outside of bankruptcy better, faster, and most importantly, much, much cheaper without having to pay the attorney's fees on both sides for dealing with the bankruptcy process. This slide is called managing your lender, but it's really managing your relationship with the lender through the process. The goal is to demonstrate initially that the owner is honest, competent, and gets it. And if you can demonstrate that you as the owner in a workout actually get it, you will separate yourself from quite a large portion of the other people who darken the door of special assets. Second, provide full information about the property and prospects. So what your lender wants is to get paid in full with principal and interest. If you can't pay your lender in full with principal and interest, then at least provide them information about the property, the finances, the prospects, what is going on. Communicate on a regular basis with your lender. One of the things that you need to communicate is that you have a plan A to deal with this difficult situation for the benefit of the lender and your own investors, and a plan B if plan A doesn't work out. And then finally, as you present these plans, it is critical to focus on the interest of your audience, who is your lender. So why is it in the lender's interest to work with you as you try to do plan A and plan B? And Gary, maybe you could go through why a lender would want to work with an owner in this context.
Yes, thank you, Dean. First, if the lender feels that the owner is actually honest, as a practical matter, the owner is going to be a lot cheaper to use than a receiver who's going to charge a much higher fee to do the same work, to collect the rents and pay expenses, operating expenses of the property. Likewise, the owner is probably in the best position to sell the property at the highest possible price. Number one, they've got the connections in the industry. They know the property better than anybody else. And if the alternative is for the lender to try to sell it as part of one piece in a large, increasingly large pile of real estate assets owned under a lender's REO portfolio, it's going to be more difficult for the lender to sell it at the higher price, the highest price, I should say. And the owner is in a situation where, at least if the lender is allowing some breathing space, it can try to sell the property outside of a forced sale context, whereas it's clear that a lender that's got REO is trying to unload is really in a forced sale situation. And as part of that, buyers are more likely to pay a higher price from a lender, from the actual owner of the property, because the owner can give reps and warranties regarding any potential defects with the property that the lender is really not in a position to give, and a buyer will pay more to get that assurance. Likewise, the lenders recognize that the owners are uniquely motivated to try to turn the property around. Frequently, as we talked about earlier, owners or the principals of the owners are on the hook on guarantees, so they really have an incentive to try to maximize value here. And that's not true to the same extent if the junior lender is going to get all the upside and there's no guarantees, then the owner has less motivation to get the best price. But having said that, there's often other factors that make motivate the owner to again, achieve the highest and best price. One is the owner typically, or the principals of the owner typically have tax liabilities that would otherwise flow from an unfavorable sale. Those include forgiveness of debt, taxes, as well as capital gain liability that may accrue to the owner. Likewise, as we mentioned earlier, the owner wants to maximize price to reduce their potential liability on the principal's guarantees. Another reason is the owner wants to keep reaping the management fees that they typically get from staying in charge of the property instead of a receiver coming in to do it. And there's also some non-economic factors. A lot of the owners have a reputation they'd like to uphold. They've spent years in the business, and they don't want to be perceived as a failure that doesn't follow through on their obligations. Having said all that, I think what it really boils down to is the folks are trying to do what's best in terms of lowering expense and lowering delay, and working it out with the owner is typically better than almost all the other alternatives, particularly a bankruptcy, which, as we mentioned earlier, is expensive and time-consuming. And in an economy where the lenders have already enough assets that are being dealt with in the special asset department, and a lot of things are not even moving, if they can find owners that they can actually work with, it's one less piece of property that they have to worry about. So now Dean's going to talk a little bit about the nuts and bolts of actually managing the workout process.
Okay, and the first step typically in a successful workout is actually moving to special assets or the equivalent of special assets. Typically with lenders, there is a group, although for many years we went from having special assets groups in banks and other lenders to not having any, but those departments are back with a vengeance now in the current economy. But you go to special assets, or you've got a conduit loan to the special loan servicer who actually has responsibility for dealing with these things once they become in default or in difficulty. The folks in special assets typically have expertise and practical realism in being able to deal with troubled loan situations. Just one reminder, for those of you who have background noise, go ahead and mute your phones. Before I kind of go through this managing the process, there are a couple of questions we had. One of them was, that by the time there's a default, the lender may already have a view that the borrower is incompetent and dishonest, and how do you turn that point of view around? I guess number one, by the time you get to special assets, you're dealing with the people who deal with troubled loans. And their experience is all of the borrowers that they see at that point are in default. And in fact, it's pretty normal to have a series of promises that have been made, or we're going to go raise some money from the investors and we're going to go find a buyer. And if you just extend the loan, we will go get this deal put together to take you out. And the way it works in the current economy is some of those things are difficult to accomplish. That doesn't make you dishonest. It means that you weren't able to deliver the solution that you wanted to then. But the fastest way to turn around the lender is to come in and say, I actually get it. I know where I am in the process. I'm prepared to provide you with full information. I'm in a difficult situation, but let me differentiate myself from the folks that you usually deal with by saying, I understand your goals are different than mine, and I have to address your goals with this solution, and I'm here to tell you I'm going to provide you full information, and I've got a plan A and a plan B to get us through that. A lot of times in the past, things did not move quickly to special assets, and one of the reasons you do move to special assets is A loan in default needs more attention, and it needs attention from people who know something about that process. Two, you actually want to move away from the guy who originated the loan, who has an incentive to tell his boss, oh, it's still fine, I'm sure it'll all work out, and, you know, it's going to be great. And you get a more realistic way to deal with things within the lender itself. After you move to special assets, the most important next step, particularly for the lender, is the execution of a pre-workout negotiation agreement. Well-advised lenders say, look, I'm happy to discuss with you forbearance or extension or whatever it is that we have to talk about, but first you need to sign my agreement, because I have had bad experiences where people kind of came in and said, we want your cooperation, and then later said, well, thank you for cooperating. Actually, you know, our loan documents are unenforceable, and, you know, my guarantee was actually, you know, forged, and, you know, we're not actually in default, and I've got the following 15 flaky lender liability theories. So what lenders do is they hand you a form of pre-workout negotiation agreement. There's typically a very brief forbearance period to discuss things where all they agree to do is, for a short period of time, they're not going to exercise their remedies. And then you agree that, in fact, the loans are in default, and that you don't have any defenses, and that you're giving up any claims that you'd have against the bank, and that is the price of playing if you want to go forward with a negotiation with your lender. Typically, then, there is a brief period of forbearance where the lender is not going to foreclose on the assets or exercise its other remedies. There's providing information to the lender, and from the borrower's perspective, remember, one of the key questions for the lender is it more trouble to deal with you than it is to foreclose? So if there is something unfortunate at the property, like an environmental problem, like there's a dispute with the city about zoning, like that there is some difficulty with a key vendor or the management agreement or something else, you certainly don't sweep that stuff under the rug, particularly if that information just makes it clear that if a lender forecloses, they're coming into a situation where it's going to require more rather than less active management, and they're better off dealing with you over those kinds of things. Speed and realism are absolutely critical to a successful loan workout. The more quickly that the borrower and the lender can both move, the better the outcomes typically are for everyone, and the more realistic both parties can be about what the real situation is, and on the borrower side, what the motives of the lender are and what you need to do in order to get a deal that works, the more likely you are to be successful. And then finally, particularly on the owner-borrower side, you actually have to get credit for contributions before you make them. So you cut your deal that calls for putting in money to create an interest reserve or, you know, pay for the renovations or pay for the negative operating income for the winter for the hotel in San Francisco. In return for some sort of forbearance or extension agreement or something, you don't simply make those to be a good guy and then ask the bank to kind of credit you for the good stuff that you've done in the past. You know, in this life, you don't get the deal you deserve, you get the deal you negotiate. So it would be well to negotiate things before you provide the consideration. Gary, why don't you talk to us about some of the deals that are doable in the current sort of, you know, well, these are deals that we see being done now in this economy.
Yes, thank you, Dean. Probably the most common deal we see being done is what's known as extension and forbearance, or also referred to as extend and pretend. And typically the lender gives a period of time to extend the obligation under the loan or the maturity on the loan in exchange for getting something back. And that something back is typically either new money coming in or the borrower transferring a piece of the upside to the lender. And the dynamic, of course, is always the how much more time the lender is willing to give versus how much more money or other consideration the borrower is willing to put in to get that extension. And, you know, typically what the borrower will say is, giving me 6 months really doesn't do me much good at all in this economy. Why should I put in all this new money just for that? And on the other flip side, the lender doesn't want to give a 2 or 3 year extension, knowing that down the road the property, you know, could be sold for a year, and they don't want to have to wait 2 or 3 years to be paid if the economy turns around quicker than some expect. So the other common deal is that new money comes in through a recapitalization, essentially, of the senior lender loan, and typically new money is only going to want to come in and be willing to put money into the property if the lender takes a haircut, the senior lender actually takes a haircut on what it's owed, and the new money essentially can jump ahead, at least to a certain extent, of the existing senior lender. Otherwise, there's not much reason why the folks putting in new money would be willing to do so. And as part of that process, to avoid this thing going downhill right away, typically the new money that's put in is set aside as an interest reserve, or at least a portion of it is, to allow the borrower to make debt service payments during whatever this interim period is agreed to. One other typical deal we're seeing more and more of is guarantors will actually put more money themselves into the deal in exchange for there being changes in their potential liability on the guarantee, either a cap on the overall dollar liability on the guarantee or limitations on when the guarantee can be enforced. And, you know, that's often a way to buy some time from the lender if the guarantee is willing to come out of pocket right now to put more money into the property. Another prospect is the borrowers typically try to convert what is regular debt service payments in a specified amount to what's known as a cash flow mortgage, meaning that the lender will only receive the cash flow that's generated by the property after paying operating expenses. Now, typically a lender won't agree to that unless they're getting something in return, and that something in return can be either a new collateral or the guarantors agreeing to take on additional liability on the guarantees, or at least agreeing to do something else. For example, put in money and time to develop the property itself, or perhaps giving the lender a piece of the upside that it didn't have before in the form of what's often known as a hope certificate. Those sort of things can incent a lender to essentially move to a so-called cash flow mortgage, at least for some interim period, until the property is kicking off enough money to pay regular debt service in a specified amount. Another possibility, and we're seeing it more and more if these other workout ideas aren't doable, is to have the borrower provide what's known as a deed in lieu, as we talked about before, where they essentially hand the keys over, or they arrange for a short sale with a new buyer who will pay less than is owed on the mortgage or on the loan in order to get a deal done. Typically, those things only work if the owner is getting something in addition to handing the keys over. And that might be an agreement that they're going to continue on as a manager of the property and get fees for that, or perhaps that the lender is going to front some funds to pay off operating expenses on the property that the owner may otherwise be on the hook for. Now, I've talked about some doable deals. Now, Dean is going to discuss some deals that, are, from a practical standpoint, are not doable.
And I think the first one that's undoable is anything that involves unrealistic owners who just can't wrap their minds around where they are. I think right today, a lot of people who think they own hotels or commercial real estate assets are just renting them, that they are actually quite underwater, that the owners currently have no equity and, in fact, are so far out of the money that it doesn't look like they're going to have equity next year either. And particularly where you've got, you know, multiple layers of debt which are accruing interest at large default rates, the owner is so far out of the money that, you know, the critical issue is the owner has to realize where the owner is and that a deal has to work for the lenders. The most common proposal that I see that is just dead on arrival is the owner says, well, look, you know, if I owe $50 million, but the asset's only worth $40 million, since it's only worth $40 million, why doesn't the lender just write the loan down to $40 million and we'll agree today that I only owe $40 million? Well, that's interesting, but the lender has to get something in return for that. Today, the lender has a promise to pay $50 million. Why should the lender exchange that for a promise to pay only $40 million if you're not going to put new money in or provide an interest reserve or otherwise do something? The third concept is if the borrower is proposing a deal that's much worse for the lender than a simple foreclosure, that is not better than the lender's alternative to a negotiated settlement. So that's not a deal that's going to go anywhere. On the flip side, a deal that leaves nothing for ownership or the guarantors except the tax problem is dead on arrival at the borrower, owner, guarantor side. That any deal really has to have something, even if it's just a sliver of hope for the future, for the people who are participating in that deal. And, you know, frankly, if real estate entrepreneurs and owners wanted to go to work for banks, they would have done that 20 years ago. They need to have some incentive on the upside to continue to operate these assets, to continue to sort of live fight another day. Finally, and this is sort of a rather frustrating issue, the one nice thing about the current economic shakeout is actually the debt of these conduit loans, because they're enormously difficult to work with, these collateralized mortgage-backed securities. It is very, very, very difficult to do a deal involving a CMBS loan. That it goes to the special servicer, and the special servicer does not want to get sued by the equivalent of the bondholders, and typically they are in multiple tranches, so if the special servicer does some sort of entrepreneurial deal that says, well, look, you know, I'll agree to a short sale or I'll agree to do the following things where you don't have to pay back the last $10 million in principal, it affects one tranche of bondholders differently from the others. So there is a potential, notwithstanding the document, for one of those groups of bondholders to say, look, you just breached your fiduciary duty to me, I'm going to sue. In addition, the REMIC rules have been modified, so after foreclosure, the special loan servicer can hang on to that property for longer without having to resell it. And at that point, they'll simply agree to a process to sell it, and they'll go market it, and whatever it gets, it gets. And it's harder to sue the special servicer if they've done all of those things and they can establish they, you know, went through this sort of marketing and they tried to get offers and all of that. So essentially, there's a limited universe of deals that are available from special loan servicers, and the deal has to come with paying substantial fees to the special servicer. And, you know, this is in the context of there is not enough money to go around to begin with. So I think the takeaway there is it is really, really, really difficult to do deals on CMBS loans. There are a bunch of particularly useful structures. One of them is the new money versus old debt negotiation. It is often very hard to persuade a lender simply to tear up its existing loan documents and substitute a different obligation which is less attractive to the lender. That becomes much easier if it's really not a negotiation between the lender and the borrower, but a negotiation with new money coming in. So whether that is a purchaser in a short sale, whether that's an existing investor, or whether that is a guarantor who says, look, I will put new money into this project, but we need to get rid of my guarantee and we need to restructure the terms. And it becomes very easy to understand why no new money would come into a project that was underwater to a lender, and that the lender actually has to reduce the principal of the note and modify the payment terms in order to get a new investment, and in fact that the new investment, which will renovate the hotel or some other asset or provide an interest reserve or all of the following, that is a deal that makes sense because it's a new money versus old debt negotiation, not just a borrower-lender negotiation. Oath certificate is a concept that's tossed around, and it is often the key to making a deal work. Let's say you've got a hotel and you're trying to restructure the senior debt, and the benefit for the holder of the mezzanine debt is that it avoids foreclosure on the senior, but no one's going to make this deal work unless the mezzanine lender also gives up a whole bunch, because then there's no upside for the new money coming in. The mezzanine lender doesn't want to get wiped out at the bottom of the market and says, look, I'm not interested because there's really nothing in it for me to take that deep of a haircut. So the answer is, well, mezzanine lender, you're going to get a hope certificate. If the following things happen when this asset is resold 5 years from now, then you get a piece of the upside, and we will negotiate in advance what the circumstances are for you to get maybe an equity interest. It is more commonly simply a contingent payment right that says, look, when cash flow improves or if the asset is sold for more than this amount of money, you get this percentage of the ups. Oftentimes, and Gary had talked about in a short sale or a deed in lieu of foreclosure, that there may be some sort of soft ownership. That may be a management or consulting agreement. So, for example, in the hotel context, you sometimes see, look, you know, we're going to go ahead and foreclose, but we would be willing to sort of let, you know, we think you guys are actually doing a good job managing these hotels. We'll agree to a one-year management agreement, and then we might extend that to the future. That's often critical in an economy like this, where real estate owners have a certain amount of fixed overhead, and they've got to have a certain amount of management fee coming in to continue to keep the doors open. Cash flow mortgage is one of the things that we talked about, which is really tying the payments to what is coming out of the asset. An interest reserve or a capital reserve is a structure that helps, because instead of the promise, well, I'll continue to put money in if necessary, at the time the loan is restructured, the borrower, the investor, the new money comes in, puts money up, which is actually in the lender's hands as an interest reserve or a capital reserve, and then if there's a future default, the lender can simply say, well, look, I, along with my security interest in the asset, I now have a security interest in the interest reserve, which is placed with me. Typically, if you analyze the tax implications for foreclosure or some of the other outcomes, if you trade something for relief on the guarantee or relief from the tax consequences, that can often be the difference between a deal that's not doable or one that is doable. So that is our webinar for today. In a moment, I'll open it up for questions, but I do want to give people a reminder. Probably by the end of this week, we will have our prior webinars up on our website, and we will get an announcement out to you about where you can find them. And then in the near future, we will schedule a further webinar, which is understanding the tax impacts of foreclosure and debt restructuring. So in our remaining 3 minutes of our hour, I want to open this up for questions if anybody wants to ask one.
Find me up from the one to all of those. Actually, I'm going to give it in.
I have a quick question. Under a CMBS securitized loan, are the special servicers limited on the term of the extension that they can provide after the ultimate maturity?
Yes, oftentimes the special servicer, you know, these things come with a pile of documents that is just immense. You know, I hope they're all moving to paperless offices, because otherwise, along with all the rest of the carnage caused by CMBS loans, is we've killed more trees than, you know, there are in North America. Typically in those documents, there are limitations on what the special servicer can agree to, and the limitations are different depending on what the loan is, so that they may have a limitation on how much of an extension they can provide after maturity of the loan.
You suggested that the best absolution for a CMBS special servicer was a sale. Are there other alternatives open?
Well, you can commonly get an extension from them and a forbearance agreement, and you can even sometimes modify the pay terms, but typically instead of saying we're going to agree that you're not going to have to pay interest at 8%, all they'll agree to is, well, we'll stop charging you interest at the default rate, because typically the default rate interest does go to the special servicer. But what they'll say is, look, we're going to, instead of you paying at the following rate, we're simply going to accrue at that rate. You're going to pay at a lower rate, and we're going to forbear for a limited period of time. That will give you some time to go refinance or find a buyer or recapitalize or something else. But in the meantime, you're going to have to pay a whole bunch of fees to us. And those deals are really hard to do, because if you had the money to pay all of these fees to them, then you wouldn't need to be doing this workout. So they tend to be frustratingly difficult to accomplish.
Does the cash flow mortgage typically have an accrual component to it as well, that accrues, say, to the previous interest rate?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand the question.
The question is, when it goes to a cash flow mortgage, is there still an accrual component if, say, the rate was 6% on the CMBS and you restructure and go to a cash flow mortgage?
Yeah, the answer is typically when you go to a cash flow mortgage, you have an accrual rate which continues at the original rate or a modified agree rate, and then the only thing that changes to the cash flow is the actual pay rate, so that it becomes, you know, oftentimes a negatively amortizing loan, or it becomes something, particularly in the hotel context, where everybody understands, look, the you know, in a particular market like San Francisco, you might have a lot of cash flow in the summer, but very poor cash flow in the winter. So it just changes. It makes for uneven payments over the year.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you all for participating in our seminar. We will send you some follow-up information that includes how you will find our prior webinars online, and then in about a week, we will put this webinar up online as well. And everyone have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.